S-A-B-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby.
Shiba, shiba. Shiba, shiba. Shiba, shiba.
Let me in.
Shiba, shiba.
I want to be closer to you.
Shiba, shiba.
Open up your soul.
Shiba, shiba.
Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello. And welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, or if it's the first Monday of the month, understand something. As you all know, my science education was sorely lacking, so it's always very exciting for me to have scientists come through the studio and talk about their stuff in a way where I actually understand it. I love it, so I'm very excited, and we're going to talk about the stars and all kinds of fun stuff, which is something that I wanted to do when I was really little. So here to talk about space, the final frontier, I'd like to welcome Daniel Belthauer. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into your actual PhD things, when did you first discover that you were interested in science and specifically interested in what's beyond our little, you know, blue marble?
Yeah, for me, my interest in astronomy really began sometime around fifth grade, because that was about the point where I would come home and I would start seeing marathons on the Science Channel of things like How the Universe Works, Into the Universe with Stephen Hawking, Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman, all of this stuff. Okay. And I just remember when they had those marathons, I would sit there for hours on end just watching all of these astronomy programs. And It was just blowing my mind, and absolutely loved it. And so once I kind of got into high school and started doing a little bit of physics and kind of began to understand what was going on, and and then got to undergrad and realized, wow, you know, could do some astronomy stuff. That's kind of where things really began to take off.
Okay, so as you're sitting there, like entirely absorbed in this, are your parents looking at you going, yep, future astronomer, and are they just keeping their fingers crossed that it's going to hold, or are they like, honey, are you okay?
They were incredibly supportive of me becoming an astronomer. They knew that I absolutely loved it. I'm from the Chicago area, and so we would go to like the Admiral Planetarium and things like that. We went on a few field trips there when I was in elementary school, and they always were very supportive of me doing that.
Now, I heard a Neil deGrasse Tyson talk about when he was a kid and he would look up in the sky and he would only see four stars in the sky from where he was. And so it took him a while to believe that all those stars were out there. What's the Chicago skyline look like when you're a little kid?
Very similar, about four stars.
Really?
Unfortunately.
So did you actually really believe that those stars were out there, or did you need some convincing?
It was kind of just for me that I felt like I knew it was out there, but I couldn't see it because of all the light pollution. And it was just kind of a question of, I told myself, when would I see that? And kind of as of this day, it's still unfortunately not. I've been in the city for most of my, almost pretty much my entire life. And so I've really never seen all that much without light pollution. And I one day by the end of my PhD, I very much want to go out into some dark rural areas and see. But I've mostly only seen it from those shows and from pictures that people take. I do follow a lot of astronomy photography things and whatnot, and so seeing a lot of that stuff. But unfortunately not really much in person. One of my big goals in life is I definitely want to see like the auroras in person.
Yeah, that would be great. I remember when I would look up at the stars, I would think, how did they name all these constellations? Because there aren't that many stars there. How did they get that? And then I went to an island in Greece. I went to Santorini, where there's millions of stars in the sky, because at that time there wasn't any light pollution in this little, you know, this little island. And then I could go, oh, now I understand how they're able to see all those pictures. So you just have to find some out of the way island that doesn't have a whole bunch of resorts.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So fast forward, you get into college. They tell you, you need a lot of math before you can do astronomy. And were you like, yay, math? Or you're like, well, it's a necessary evil to get through to astronomy.
I think I was very fortunate when I was growing up, because I know this is certainly not the case for a lot of people, that they're supported in kind of their math journey. Mm-hmm. I always think of math kind of as more of a language that you're kind of, that you kind of learn when you're younger. And if you're introduced to it at a young age, then I think, and you're supported and nourished with that, then I think it kind of comes a lot more naturally. And thankfully that was the case for me, but I very much recognize that's not the case for a lot of people. And so for my life, I've kind of taken to math. It's made a lot of sense to me, I think, because of that early education and support.
Okay. So now here we are. You're in your fourth year working towards your PhD. And what is your specialty?
So my specialty, basically, I work all about how does the universe produce the heaviest metals in the periodic table?
What are the heaviest metals?
And so these kind of range from things that we know in our daily lives, like perhaps if you have any jewelry, it might be gold and silver. Mm-hmm. Or, of course, there are a lot of other metals that I kind of am interested in that we may not think about as much in our day-to-day, but are still nonetheless important. These are things like some of the metals in, like, engines and, like, the spark plugs of cars and whatnot. And so kind of the question that I focus on is, how exactly did the universe produce all of those metals, and how did they ultimately get to Earth?
Okay, so when you talk about heavy metals, like when I think of gold, I think of gold as actually something really light. Like, so how, a pound of gold is the same as a pound of anything, so what makes them heavy versus any other thing? Is it mass or what is it?
Yeah, so when you basically look down at the smallest possible unit of whatever that element is, a single atom of it, we basically divide heavy metal by how heavy is that particular atom. And so every atom is comprised of a nucleus with protons and neutrons in its center, and those are basically what gives give the element its mass, and that's surrounded by a bunch of electrons. And so heavy metals, basically, for astronomy, we kind of define that as anything that's something like there's more than something like 60, 80 of neutrons and protons in the very center of that atom.
Okay, so it's all about the atoms.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. And so gold is one. What were some of the others?
Gold is a big one. Silver. Lead is also one of them. Uranium, perhaps people might be a bit more familiar with. Some of the more kind of strange ones that you probably don't see in your everyday life is something like iridium or zirconium. But those are still kind of grouped into this heavy metal category that I'm interested in.
Okay, and you're trying to figure out how the universe came up with these, or
exactly, yeah, because you know we dig into the Earth and we see these elements, but you know how exactly did the Earth manage to get them? Where did those elements come from?
So, when you look at these heavy metals, can you say that you find them throughout the universe, or do we only know that we can find them here?
Oh, we know that they're all across the universe. So what we're able to do is all of these atoms, kind of the big key of astronomy is that every element effectively leaves a fingerprint in light.
Okay.
Because what we do as astronomers is we say, we look at all the light that's coming to us and is available. And so those are all different wavelengths of light.
Okay.
And so those correspond to different energies of light. And so these are things like optical light, for example, what we use to see all around us. Mm-hmm. Infrared light, which is something that our bodies give off as heat and we feel it that way.
Oh,
or
okay.
Ultraviolet radiation, which is basically what gives us sunburns. And so these are all different kinds of light and these are all different energies of light.
Okay.
And so what we do as astronomers is we basically look at these stars and whatnot that are nearby, and we break it down and we look at how much light is there of a specific energy. And so these elements, they actually leave fingerprints. And this is what we call a spectrum, because these fingerprints are basically little dips and wiggles that we see in the amount of light. Perhaps they absorb a lot more, and so we see a lacking of light at a very particular energy. And so that's exactly how we're able to figure out that these elements exist not just here on Earth, but also in our sun, in other stars around around our galaxy, kind of just all over the place.
So you take some random star out in the universe. You're looking at the light that is coming off of it, and you're like, that star is made out of gold?
There's a lot of modeling that goes into it. As far as we know, there are no stars that are entirely made out of gold.
Okay.
They're by far mostly composed of the simplest element, hydrogen, which is just one proton and one electron.
Okay, and they're gaseous, right?
Exactly, yeah, they're gaseous. And so basically you try to identify where all of those little wiggles and whatnot are to, so that you can say, oh, this particular fingerprint pattern matches this element. And so we know that there's this that this exists here. And then you can do a lot more complicated modeling with math and whatnot to try to figure out exactly how much. And you kind of go through all of the elements to try to pick that out.
Is that only on stars, or can you do that with the planets as well?
At this point, it's very difficult to do that with planets, with planets outside of our solar system.
Inside our solar system?
Inside our solar system, you certainly can do, and you can tell things. A lot of the planets have multi-atom things that we can see, and so those are things like I believe that there's a lot of methane in some places in our own solar system that we're able to identify and whatnot. But for the most part, it's largely just single atoms that we're able to identify and pick out.
Okay. So when you're looking at the stars, and they're largely gaseous, but you know that a bunch of different wavelengths are coming off of each star,
right?
Like zip, 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 zip. So it's like maybe like I think of the star as like my head, and then all these wiggles are my hair.
Yeah.
And then you can go, oh, I can see from that squiggle there that that's gold, and that one is zirconia, and that one's this, and that one's that. So how are you able to – it seems like there would be a lot of noise. Like they would – the waves would mix up together. So how do you distinguish one wave from another?
Yeah. So we distinguish the different light from each other by specifically the amount of energy they have, because the energy of a particular an individual unit of light that we always talk about is called a photon.
Okay.
And so the energy of a photon is exactly correlated to its wavelength. And so if we spread it out and we look at essentially a graph of what is the wavelength of light and how much there is, and we can basically tell everything apart by looking at where all of those dips and wiggles occur.
Okay.
And so there isn't as much of a mix-up, because you can say, okay, we see over here that there's a dip right here. This corresponds to this particular element. There's a dip over here. This one corresponds to that one.
Okay.
And then you usually use the pattern of dips overall to, exactly like you were saying, disentangle exactly what element is what. You got to use multiple dips.
Okay. So when you describe that process, then it feels more like you got a giant like afro of wavelengths that you can easily pick out this wavelength or that wavelength. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have instances where wavelengths overlap so you can't really tell what's going on?
Oh, there are certainly situations where things are confusing and messy. But for the most part, it's kind of all just goes into that modeling of, well, you know, we got to understand how we ultimately get the light that we see.
Okay.
And so, you know, we need 10% hydrogen in order to produce this, or we need 15% helium, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And so understanding those models is what really helps us disentangle all of that.
Okay. So when you went into studying how the universe creates these heavy metals, what was it that first drew you to it, and then what was something that surprised you as you started to study it?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that really drew me to it was basically we only have observational evidence of the production of these very heavy elements. Within the past 7 years. It was literally 2017. That was the first time that we knew for sure. that we saw a site where we produce, where the universe produces these incredibly heavy elements.
Only like in the last seven.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
That was the first time.
So before that, it was just supposition, or were people like, no, it didn't, not possible?
Everybody was kind of guessing. They were saying, you know, this seems pretty likely,
okay.
But we never had any observational evidence. We never knew for certain.
So how did you, in 2017, what changed that was so that people could go, now we know?
So the big thing is, and this has been going, this has been a work in progress for more than a century. So in the early 1900s, Einstein basically predicted that there would be these things called gravitational waves.
Okay.
And so gravitational waves are quite literally ripples in the very fabric of space-time itself.
Okay.
And so it's like if you kind of throw a pebble into a pond and you see all those ripples
traveling
outwards.
Okay.
And what a gravitational wave is it's literally a stretching and compressing of distances.
Okay.
And so if there was a gravitational wave that is, say, traveling through a television screen or something in front of you, and there was an array of dots, you would see those dots shifting back and forth and up and down if there was a strong enough gravitational wave traveling through.
Okay.
And so basically what happened is, so Einstein had this prediction, hey, you know, this is something that we should see. And so people have been working on trying to develop instruments sensitive enough to be able to detect these.
Okay.
Because to kind of give you a sense of scale, so I've been talking about, you know, it's a change in distance that we can measure. But these changes in distances are incredibly small. It's basically the equivalent of if I were to know the precise distance from the Earth to the Sun to the level of a single bacteria.
Wow.
So knowing the distance, though it is that small of a distance change that they're able to observe. And they've been working on this, like I said, for about that 100 years.
Uh-huh.
And so basically what happened is in 2017, we start seeing this signal of a gravitational wave coming through Earth, which is matched a lot of models coming from the collision, or coming from the in-spiral of these objects called neutron stars.
That had to be so exciting.
Oh, it absolutely was.
I bet they were like triple and quadruple checking because are we sure that this is what we're really seeing?
And so this signal was only something like 30, 40 seconds long. So they didn't have a very long time to be doing this.
Okay.
But these neutron stars, kind of as the name implies, are kind of these incredibly dense balls of neutrons.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are kind of the remnants of what's left over after a star explodes at the end of its life.
Okay.
And so these come from stars that are something like about eight times or more the mass of our sun.
Okay.
And so our sun will not be doing this. We'll not be leaving behind one of these things, but stars that are more massive will. And so these neutron stars, basically, they're in spiraling around each other.
Okay.
And so you can kind of think of it as you're dragging your finger through the surface of a pond around one another. And it's generating these waves.
Oh, okay.
And so those waves are coming because they're just so massive and so dense. These things are something like about 1.5 times the mass of the sun, but compressed down into about the size of San Francisco.
Okay.
So a typical estimate that I usually hear is that if you were to get like a single little spoonful of, these things are like 30 million elephants worth of mass. Incredibly dense and incredibly massive objects.
An apple versus a poppy seed.
Yeah. So incredibly, incredibly dense. And so basically, so scientists it was the LIGO Gravitational Wave Observatory, the Laser Interferometry Gravitational Wave Observatory.
Okay.
So they saw this signal of these two in-spiraling neutron stars. And so basically the key is that they saw these things merge in the signal because they spin faster and faster, and so the waves get faster and faster.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately after that, there was a slight gap, which is quite interesting in time, but maybe we can get into it later if that's something of interest. But there's a little brief pause in time, and then there was an incredibly energetic burst of light that we saw called a short gamma ray burst.
Mm.
And so these are incredibly powerful beams of incredibly high energy light. Gamma rays are the most high energy light that we know of.
Okay.
Perhaps, you know, you've seen the comics with the Hulk. You know, I think his whole deal of how he got turned into the Hulk was with gamma rays. So it's kind of kind of a thing. And so it had been long theorized that these gamma ray bursts would be, these short gamma ray bursts would be associated to these collisions of neutron stars.
Oh, okay.
And so the fact that we had this gravitational wave signal, then we had this gamma ray burst. Mm-hmm. So that was very good signs. And then over the course of about 12 hours, people were trying to figure out where exactly in the sky this was occurring.
Okay.
And it was something like 12 hours later that then as people were comparing images, what was it like before? What is it now like now? They saw a little faint pinprick of light that was just beginning to get brighter.
Okay.
And so this is the thing that I study. And so this is how a lot of the universe produces these heavy elements. And so this bright emission that we see afterwards, not the short gamma ray burst, is called a kilonova. And so this kilonova, all the light that comes out of it is produced by basically the synthesis of all these incredibly heavy metals.
Okay.
And specifically, all of these incredibly heavy metals, once they're synthesized, are extremely radioactive.
Okay.
You're producing wide amounts of this material, and they radioactively decay.
Okay.
And all of that energy goes into all of this material that's been made and is spewing out into the cosmos at this point, and it glows. And so basically, this material, so when we look at exactly that same spectrum that I was talking about earlier, how much light is there of all of these different wavelengths, the biggest key was that there was a lot of that infrared light. And so the infrared, that heat light that we perceive as heat, is a very key characteristic of the production of these heavy elements. And so the fact that, so we saw the gravitational wave signal, we saw this short gamma ray burst, and then we saw this transient, this short-lived burst of light. So this particular thing lasted something about like a week, couple of weeks or so, which is kind of short in astronomical terms.
Yeah.
And that it had this, it was this brightness in infrared, kind of all of that evidence together that told us that these heavy elements had been synthesized. And we just witnessed it for the first time.
So people must have been flying, like they heard it and they were like, get me on the next plane. I want to see it for myself. Was it that kind of excitement?
It was incredibly exciting, but it was a little bit funny time-wise because actually this was right around the time that the eclipse was happening in 2017.
Oh.
And so a lot of astronomers were actually on vacation at this point and going out and looking at the eclipse here in the U.S.
Yeah. Oh,
so it was a big flurry of people trying to get, you know, whatever telescopes they could pointed at this thing.
That's great. Well, no, but that's good because they would have had their personal telescopes with them anyway, so.
To see this kind of thing, you need very powerful telescopes to be able to see this kind of thing. So unfortunately, our backyard, couple inch telescopes would not have been sufficient
for this. Understood. So what was that blip of, you said time stopped or something like that? Was it like the eye of the hurricane?
So with the gravitational wave signal, you can see in the signal where basically the collision happens. And it's quite literally this chirp because basically the frequencies that these gravitational waves occur at are actually in the auditory band. So you can totally look up on YouTube or whatever. I do this for any presentation I have where I talk about this. There you can listen to the signal itself.
Okay.
And so basically, as these things get closer and closer, the frequency goes up and it gets louder.
Uh-huh.
And so you literally hear a chirp kind of sound.
Uh-huh.
And so the end of that chirp is where you know that collision happens.
Okay.
And then there was basically it was a 1.5 or so second delay between the end of that chirp and the beginning of the short gamma ray burst.
Okay.
And
like,
it's
like in the movies, you know, when they have like you see, you know, in the spy movies where there's the impact and then the explosion.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a tiny little.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of interesting physics that people are still kind of curious about exactly what's going on in there. That was a very interesting point of contention that people are trying to figure out exactly why is it that 1.5 second delay? What's going on?
And would that have something to do with how quickly they hit or they're still supposing what it could be, what the delay is?
People think that it kind of has to do essentially with – so these neutron stars, like I said, are incredibly dense. And so when they impact each other, they basically make all this dense cloud of material around them. And so kind of the main idea that people have is that they think that it takes a lot of time for that gamma ray burst to punch through all of that material.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of an interesting thing to kind of consider exactly how long that time delay is. Gets you into a lot of interesting physics.
Okay. So and then the question of what surprised you when you started to study this?
Mm-hmm.
Was something you didn't expect or something that just turned your head, blew your mind?
Yeah, I think probably the coolest thing that I didn't really know about this going into it was so part of the reason that we were relatively confident that this is one of the sources of how the universe produces some of the heaviest elements,
mm-hmm.
Is that so kind of when we were talking about earlier, you know, where do we see the gold in the universe? Where do we see all of this? What was very perplexing is that we saw, so we can take good, really good measurements of our own star, our sun, and mm-hmm. look at exactly, you know, how much of each element there is. And so we had that, and we're like, great, you know, let's look at other stars. Let's look at this. And when you look at other stars, it's kind of the same pattern, more or less, of elements. You see, like, a little bit more of this element and a little bit less of this particular one.
Okay.
And so people are like, okay, you know, that's kind of interesting. Same pattern as our own sun, interesting. And then they kind of look elsewhere, and it's again and again and again and again.
Oh.
And so it's basically the same amount. It's the same ratio of all of these elements,
okay.
kind of all across the universe.
Uh-huh.
And so this is very interesting. And this pointed to basically this one very particular way that that these heavy elements are formed, which is called the R process.
Mm-hmm.
And so this basically is a fancy word. It's a fancy way that we describe the longer name is called the rapid neutron capture process. Because
okay.
basically the way that you make these elements is that – so you have a particular element sitting there
uh-huh.
and you add a whole bunch of neutrons to mm-hmm. it in really rapid succession.
Okay.
And so basically that makes it really radioactive.
Okay.
And it will decay down mm-hmm. into lighter elements. And it will make those heavy elements. And so when you undergo this R process, when this material is produced through R process, it produces that very specific pattern of elements that we mm-hmm. see everywhere.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that to me, I think, was just very interesting that we're able to see this same exact process happen all over the universe.
So does that mean that the heavier elements are just almost harder to create because...
Yes.
Because of how dense they are on an atomic and subatomic level.
Yeah, you're hitting it exactly on the head right now. These things are incredibly difficult to make. They require extremely specific conditions,
okay.
which are only met in, say, the collisions of these neutron stars.
Okay.
There are a couple of other ideas of where people might be able, where the universe might be able to produce this, but
mm-hmm.
at least as of now, there's no observational proof.
So when they, because they require a very specific set of circumstances to create them. Do they need a very specific set of circumstances to break them apart, to melt them, to turn them into a gas where they are no longer?
So these things, when they collide, they're incredibly hot. And
uh-huh.
so they kind of already are a bit of a gas,
okay.
a little bit, because these things are hundreds of millions of degrees already.
Okay. But still that heavy metal. Just,
yeah.
Okay, so
it's
super hot heavy metal, super hot lead, we'll say.
Mm-hmm. So you know, it just takes time for these things to expand, and then they'll mix into kind of the surrounding gas and dust
mm-hmm.
and then go on to form kind of the planets that we see around us.
Has there been any discovery of an element out there that isn't on Earth?
I think everything that we've seen, I do not believe that there are any, discoveries of new elements or anything.
Okay.
So, a lot of the elements that we already experience on Earth, kind of and the pushing the limits of what we know, those
mm-hmm.
things cannot be really produced naturally. We're already kind of, for the most part, we've kind of filled out the periodic table. We know kind of where all the elements are. And so anything that hasn't been produced is almost certainly not going to be produced in nature because
it takes... But when you think about how vast the universe is, Earth is very tiny. Earth has a very different composition, like a planet has a different composition from the stars. And the periodic table only has, what, 137?
Like, yeah, 120.
And it just seems that there would be more things out there than could be produced on our little planet with our makeup. So do people think that there's more beyond, or do they think this is pretty much it?
I think we feel pretty confident that we're not going to be discovering any new elements or anything because it's already hard enough to produce these heavy metals that I'm talking about. And so you'd need some even more extreme circumstances, which I certainly don't know of any extreme circumstances that you'd be able to produce, especially since a lot of the elements that are outside of our own planet, that is, the universe is almost entirely made up of hydrogen and helium. And so basically that's kind of what you're working with.
Okay. How far out have you witnessed these explosions and these creations of gold and all the heavy metals?
Yeah. So basically, so this one that happened in 2017, it is incredibly fortunate because it was quite close by. And when I say quite close by, it was astronomers usually talk in megaparsecs, but to kind of give you a little bit more of a sense, so this thing was at roughly 40 megaparsecs.
And what's a parsec?
And a parsec is basically this distance scale that astronomers usually use. Mm-hmm. And so a megaparsec is a million of those.
Oh, okay.
And it's a weird convoluted thing that we came up with, this parsec distance.
Sure, sure, sure.
But kind of the better estimate is when we talk in light years, because that's a little bit more intuitive. It's the distance that light will travel in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so this thing is somewhere around, I think it'd be around 200 million light years away.
Oh, okay.
So basically this thing happened and
that's relatively close.
Yeah. Oh, and that's okay. The close one.
Okay.
So, you know, this thing happened when I think 200 million years ago, somewhere around like when the dinosaurs were just starting out, something like that. I'm not a paleontologist. Please don't. If anybody's out there as a paleontologist, please don't be too mad. And this was a close one. And so the farthest one that we've ever seen, is something like about five times that distance.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
About five times. And that was a very faint detection that we have for that, because these things are called kilonova. These kilonova are quite faint. They're bright, but compared to a lot of things in the universe, they're actually quite faint and so difficult to detect.
Okay, okay. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We are in the studio talking about heavy metals and what does knowing how heavy metals are created, what does that add to, like, how can you use that practically? What's a practical application for that information?
Yeah, so how kind of – it's – more so understanding kind of, you know, how does the universe go about producing this? And I think that this can also kind of clue us in a little bit to, you know, if we're perhaps ever going to be a spacefaring civilization or something like that. You know, there's a lot of talk of asteroid mining. And so perhaps this will kind of get into what we might expect out of asteroid mining or things like that. You know, that's certainly far off in the future, and I don't think that'll be happening in my lifetime. That'll kind of clue us in for things like that and kind of understanding. And I think also kind of one thing that it kind of does for me a little bit is it kind of really brings a sense of togetherness, I think, with the universe and kind of everything that's out there, because, you know, we're all kind of sharing in this way that the universe produces these heavy metals. And I think that's kind of just very cool.
So for, like, I know that there are people out there with youngins who have been also bitten by the astronomy bug. For those people, what would you recommend as, say, some reading material or online resources that they could direct their kids to, or even their own inquiring minds, to help them understand what you're talking about?
You know, actually, this is a very good plug for one of the outreach events that I run.
Yay.
So I run, I'm a part of a team with two other people, Natasha Abrams and Natalie LeBaron, mm-hmm. Who run Astro Night out of UC Berkeley.
Ooh.
And so basically, it is a once a month lecture series where we do a public lecture followed by a couple hours of stargazing.
Ah.
And so this is the first Thursday of every month.
Okay.
I will say, unfortunately, because of weather and, you know, things get cloudy around
here.
We did just end our season, actually. But we'll be starting up again in April.
Okay.
So, you know, if you want to come out to Astro Night over at UC Berkeley I don't know the exact day of what the first Thursday of April is yet. No, I can check it out at some point. But that, I think, is a really good resource because we get speakers from the department and kind of from the other astro-adjacent people and bring them in. And they give a very interesting lecture, public talk, and then people can go and stargaze as they want. And we also upload all of our videos to YouTube as well. So there's a YouTube page. If you just search UC Berkeley Astro Night, that should be one of the first things that comes up, and you can easily see that. Other things I'd recommend, I kind of have a little bit of a soft spot for How the Universe Works and Through the Wormhole with Morgan Freeman and Into the Universe with Stephen Hawking and all that. I love all of those things. And also, there are a whole myriad of books as well. Kind of like you mentioned, there's some from Neil deGrasse Tyson. I know that there are a couple other books by Carl Sagan. He's also a very popular astronomer who, from a couple decades ago. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of other people as well. I know Katie Mack has written a book. She's a pretty famous astronomer who's written a couple of books. Go to your library, check out the astronomy section. Support your local public library.
Excellent. And what's the name of the lab that you're doing research for?
So I am actually part of the T-Rex group at UC Berkeley, it is transients, extragalactic.
Excellent. Well, Daniel Bretthauer, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've given me a lot to think about, and I know that you have reignited people's fascination with astronomy.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate
this. You're welcome. People of Earth, and I mean this literally, people of Earth, there's so much out there science-wise to learn and discover, and there's so many scientists who are able to help you understand this stuff, and there's so much information out there that you can read and actually learn from. Not, you know, don't accept everything you read. Read a bunch of things, put it all together, do the scientific method to figure it out. Coming up next, we're going to be talking with a member of the Dance Along Nutcracker, but let's listen to some Billy Preston and Out of Space. We'll be right back. Oh yeah, Billy Preston, Out of Space. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO, San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Well, San Francisco has a holiday tradition called the Dance-Along Nutcracker. Here to talk about this year's show, I'd like to welcome Doug Litwin. Hello.
Hi, Marilyn. Good to be here again.
I'm glad you're here. So let's talk about, first of all, the band that you're with that does the Dance Along Nutcracker changed their name. So what's the new name and how did that come about?
Well, the new name since late May is the San Francisco Pride Band. Mm-hmm. And we know it's going to take a while for everyone to learn the new name. In fact, a lot of people never quite got our old name correct, even though we've had it since 1991. That name that we changed from was the San Francisco Lesbian Gay Freedom Band. Mm-hmm. And that name has been around since 91. The original name was the San Francisco Gay Freedom Day Marching Band and Twirling Corps,
okay,
which was even more of a mouthful. And that was because the group was originally created to march in the Pride Parade in 1978. At that time, that was the name of the parade, the San Francisco Gay Freedom Day Parade.
Uh-huh.
Then the parade has changed its name many times. Mm-hmm. The band changed in 1991. But this year we wanted to make the name much more inclusive and send very different messages to everyone who hears it about who we are, who we want to appeal to, who mm-hmm. we want to join us. And it was about a two-year process of meetings and surveys and focus groups. And it led to the name change, which was announced late May.
So what's the new message?
The new message. I don't have our mission statement memorized,
no,
but it's at sfprideband.org, our new website address. It's really the same message, but the name communicates a lot. And we heard from a number of people who went ahead and joined the group
mm-hmm.
that they didn't feel very comfortable that the name addressed all parts of the LGBTQ plus community.
Mm. Oh, okay.
And the name is designed to do that. I think this band was maybe the first group in the – well, it was the first musical, openly gay musical organization in the world. And they used the words gay and then later lesbian and gay in the name of the group, which many, many groups do not do.
Mm-hmm.
They use euphemisms like pride and freedom and community – and so on. And we examined every word in the name and what we're trying to communicate and chose the Pride Band.
Got it. So you said it was back in 1978. Was that the first time the band existed?
Yes.
Okay.
It was founded to march in that parade, maybe only the one time, but obviously, it caught on.
Okay, so you've been doing. I can't do the math that quickly.
40.
In my head.
We have. It's been 46 years. We're 46.
Wow.
And we're already talking about what we might want to do to celebrate our 50th anniversary, which is gonna be here before you know it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to come up with some really large breakthrough, out of the box thinking ideas, which could take a couple years to pull off.
Maybe invite those twirlers back too.
Well, the twirlers come every now and then when we can.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Excellent. So when did you guys first do a Dance Along Nutcracker?
That was 1985.
Okay.
Which happened to be my first year in the band. In fact, the first rehearsal I ever attended was right after Labor Day in 1985, and it was uh-huh. the first rehearsal for the very first Dance Along Nutcracker.
Wow.
And it's been going ever since.
So this is number 39?
I think so, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I had no idea.
But it would be really easy if we did what a lot of groups do, the opera, the ballet, and so on, and did the same show every year.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people like it. It's part of the annual holiday family tradition and
mm-hmm.
so on.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't do that. We have a new show every year. We always feature the music from the Nutcracker Ballet by Tchaikovsky,
mm-hmm.
but we wrap it around a completely different story every year
mm-hmm.
with lots of other music and singers and dancers and actors and a plot and little twists and that's why every show is unique.
I remember going to a show a long time ago. I was probably in my like 20s or 30s or early
wasn't that
30s.
Long ago.
Long time ago. But I remember there was like a snake dancer, and there was all manner of fun stuff. So, and then when I started to do the show, I would, like you have different themes. Like there was when I came in, it was like a Wizard of Oz,
Wizard of Oz.
Had pirate themes, and there was a Harry Potter one. So
we've done going to outer space. We've done a Hawaiian themed one. We've done a Western one. It was called Blazing Nutcrackers. we did one called Snowbound, in which San Francisco was inundated by a blizzard one winter in the middle of the Stahlbaum holiday party. And there's a lot more. We did an I Love Lucy one way back in the day. Yeah, when people remembered who I Love Lucy is. We've just done so many, and we don't seem to be running out of ideas, but it is more work to create a whole new show every year, and we're doing it again this year. And this year's show, which you know very well because you are a cast member and the choreographer, it's called Mission Nutcracker. It's like a spy mystery with all kinds of twists and whodunit, and that's this year's theme. It's completely different from any theme we've used before.
Now, what sort of response do you guys get from the people? Because now that I know that it's been around for so long, you must have people who saw it when they were kids.
We do. We have some – well, let me go back. In 1985, the show was conceived as something for the gay community, for a gay, you know, adult LGBTQ plus people to – kick up their heels, enjoy a holiday show with a couple of twists, and actually participate and dance along a little bit along the way and releasing their inner child or their inner ballerina. And then that was it. But after about 5, 6, 7, 8 years, we noticed the composition of the audience was changing. It wasn't all adults anymore. There were a lot of kids showing up with their parents, sometimes multi-generational groups were coming to the audience. And we thought, well, this is interesting. And so we've gone from all nighttime shows to today, where 3 of the 4 shows we do are daytime shows. And I'm guessing 75% of the audience are families with kids. And it's remarkable to have witnessed that change. And yes, we do have parents who came to the show when they were little and now bringing their little ones to the show. And because the show's different every year, people don't have to sit, well, we saw it last year or we saw it 10 years ago. It's the same thing, right? Well, it's not.
So how many people are in the San Francisco Pride Band at any given time?
Well, at any given time, it can vary. I would say for the marching band, we're 3 bands in one. The marching band, which is the most visible group, reaches its peak in late June during Pride Month, and that can be about 80, 85 people on the street. Musicians, not including the flag corps, a twirler, all the support people. And then the dance song Nutcracker, we're a little bit limited on space at the theater where we put it on because we have to allow enough room for people to sit and enough floor space for people to dance. But that's going to be about 70 people there. And then we have a what we call a pep band, which is what we're playing at tonight. Little plug. At 6 o'clock, they're lighting the annual holiday tree at 18th Street in Castro. Right in the heart of the Castro. And they always invite our group to play Christmas carols. Lots of people come out. And for a pep band event like that, maybe it's 25 or 30 people.
And what time is that tonight?
6 o'clock, I believe. Right at 18th and Castro. And there's other entertainment also. And Santa comes by on a fire truck. And there's politicians who always speak. And then they count down and light the tree.
Excellent.
So the band is about 70, 75 people, and we're crammed onto that little stage area because, again, it's limited space.
Now, whenever I mention the Dance Along Nutcracker, people who've never gone to it before, they don't understand what it really means, and I'm going to let you talk about what happens during a dance along.
Okay. Thank you. During the Dance Along Nutcracker, there is a structure to this show. Mm-hmm. There's an overture, just like at any show, where the audience sits and enjoys the band playing it. And then the actors come out and they establish the scene. And as in the actual original Nutcracker Ballet, it always starts at the Stahlbaum family home, mm-hmm. where they're getting ready for the holiday party. And people are coming over to be a part of it. And then it changes. And then other characters come in. And after about 5 minutes of talking and setting the stage for the story, they say, why don't we have a dance? And then the lights come up a little in the theater. There's this large message that flashes up on the in front of the stage that says, get ready to dance along.
Oh, okay.
And then the audience, that's their cue to stand up and get ready. And then the first piece we play is the Overture Miniature mm-hmm. from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. People stand up and they dance along and they have a great time. And a lot of people come in costumes, which we totally encourage.
Mm-hmm.
And then people sit down, and it's sometimes a little hard to get the kids to sit down again. And then the story continues.
Mm-hmm.
And there will be other singing numbers featuring members of the cast, including yourself. You're playing two characters this year, I believe.
No, I'm just playing the one.
Just one?
Just the one.
Okay. Well, anyway. And then after another 5 or 6 minutes of storytelling, then we do another dance.
Mm-hmm.
And the dance-along numbers are usually – almost all of them are from the Nutcracker.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally we'll mix in another song that's not at all from the Nutcracker, but we want the audience to get up and dance along and participate. And some of them, as you know, are like group choreographed numbers
mm-hmm.
where we teach people a particular dance move and everybody does it at some point in the show all together. And then the story continues, dance and story, dance and story. And then there's an intermission. And during the intermission, the band goes backstage.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all wearing tuxedos in the first act. But backstage, it becomes chaos because everyone is changing into a new outfit and different sections of the band will be dressed up as different characters consistent with the theme of the show.
Right.
So, for example, this year with the spy mystery thing,
mm-hmm.
there are James Bond characters, there are Pink Panthers, there's Inspector Clouseau. There's a group doing Austin Powers, and I think you get the idea.
Yes, yes.
And then the audience, after the intermission, during which, by the way, they can go in the back of the theater where there's our Tutus R Us boutique.
Uh-huh.
And we sell and rent tutus and other accessories and mm-hmm. fairy wands and crowns. A lot of kids come dressed up, but some of them don't, and then they get into it and they buy stuff at the intermission.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, then everyone sits down. And the band does a costume parade because we've all changed.
Mm-hmm.
We enter through the lobby and we're playing music
mm-hmm.
and we're all coming in to show off the custom costumes that we've all changed into.
Mm-hmm.
And then they sit down and the show continues. And it's more singing, more acting, more storyline, more dance along. And then towards the end, the situation resolves itself. In this year's show, they're getting ready for the holiday party at the beginning, and they're going to have a talent show at the Stahlbaum party. And they're going to give this golden Nutcracker trophy to the person with the most talent. But then the trophy disappears. Someone stole it.
Chaos ensues.
Clara and Fritz, her brother Fritz, become like honorary detectives to figure out who stole it. And all these suspects emerge, and by the end of the show, there's a surprise. And
so when and where for Dance Along Nutcracker or Mission Nutcracker?
Mission Nutcracker. The 2024 Dance Along Nutcracker will take place this Saturday and Sunday, December 7 and 8. Saturday, 3 p.m. and 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday, 11 a.m., 3 p.m. They're all happening at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. 701 Mission Street, San Francisco, which is easy walking distance from Muni, BART, mm-hmm. and so on. And I guess it's okay to announce this mystery, but there's a special promo code
Ooh.
For listeners of your radio station.
Which is?
Which is Spy Twist, SPYTWIST, for KPOO listeners to get 20% off on general admission tickets. So people go to dancealongnutcracker.org, all one word, and that's where they can learn more about the show, see videos, buy the tickets, put in Spy Twist as the promo code, and see you on the weekend.
All right. Well, Doug Litwin, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're welcome, Marilyn. I'll see you at rehearsal tomorrow.
Yeah, you will. Yeah, you heard it. I'm in the show. So it wasn't a shameless plug, just like the show. It is time for me to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
Every night your line is busy, all that buzzing makes me dizzy. Couldn't count on all my fingers, all the dates you had with swingers. But